moved to Vancouver when I was about a year old. My father was a sales manager for Marshall Wells, an ex-soldier in the Great War. He also served in the Second World as well. Interesting thing about him, he was commissioned in the field on November the 11th, 1918, the very last day of the war. And he served with his same unit in World War II as well. School. I graduated from school in 41, and the day I wrote the last exam, I marched down the recruiting depot and joined up with a close friend of mine, and in due course arrived overseas as a reinforcement to the Seaforth Howlers in Great Britain. And that would be in the fall of 41. There was all these great parties when we left, etc. However, I wasn't to know that 6 months later I would be back in Canada getting my commission. I was promoted pretty rapidly because of previous service, of course, and you sort of stood out if you knew what you were doing. And so by March of 42, I was a sergeant. Somewhat underage. I was only 17 at the time. I was returned to Canada for my commission, which was kind of a shock to me. I really didn't want to come home. I didn't figure I'd been abroad long enough to be coming home. However, I got commissioned in April of 42 at Gordon Head, where your campus is now. And from there, I was posted to Camp Borden, where I did my advanced training and got promoted to lieutenant. Then I did a short tour of duty in Cornwall, Ontario at a basic training center, then back to Camp Borden, where I completed an Armored Corps qualification as an Armored Corps officer as well as an infantry officer.
If I could maybe just interrupt, do you think we could go back to Vancouver?
Yeah.
Like the Seaforth Founders while you're in the militia. How were you involved with them exactly? Like how much of your week was spent?
Two nights a week, summer camp. I used to get out of school early. It was a great thing. If my marks were relatively good, and even if they weren't so good, the principal of the school would let you go if you were going to Army camp. And so we used to go to camp 38. We went to Sydney. 39, we went to Vernon. And I used to go with the advance party, which was about a week ahead of the arrival of the battalion, a week or 10 days, and stay for the 2 weeks training, and then come home with the rear party. And it provided me with a month's employment in pretty difficult times. As I say, first in Sydney and then in Vernon. The training was very much the same as it is in the militia today, except there was more of us. When the war broke out, the battalion didn't really have to enlist more than about 150 men to bring it up. It was a poor man's club. The officers didn't get paid. Well, they got paid, but they were expected to turn it all back into the battalion, which they did. the rest of us got paid. I guess the highlight was the visit of the King and Queen in 39, and I was the youngest soldier on the Regimental Guard of Honor at the CPR station. I was so young, as a matter of fact, that the King stopped and asked me my age. Yeah, I lied to him. Because I had to.
Oh, you had
because
to?
I was underage to be even a boy soldier. You were supposed to be 16, and I wasn't, of course. I was 15.
So you lied to
me. Yeah. I sort of mumbled, I guess. I was a little shocked to be spoken to by the King. We were all given, as a memento of that occasion, a newly minted silver dollar, as I recall. My mother still has it. Mm-hmm. So that was my first brush with royalty. As it turned out, it wasn't to be my last, but it was my first. Pretty much, it was a question of going to school. It was a question of my spare time was all taken up with the Army. Tuesday nights, Thursday nights, and Friday nights, generally. There were NCO schools, there were special schools. In the summers, in addition to summer camp for the militia, they used to run the Royal Schools at Work Point, where specialized training was given. And so the summer of 38, I attended the Royal School in physical training at Work Point Barracks, which was conducted by NCOs from the regular Army garrison here. And in the summer of 39, after coming home from the summer camp in Vernon, I attended the gas course at Work Point Barracks. So that those years provided me with sort of full-time employment for the whole summer.
Mm-hmm.
At no great lump of money, mind you. Boy soldiers, I guess that's picking it up.
Yeah.
And boy soldiers in those days got 50 cents a day and a considerable amount of abuse from the battalion orderly sergeant, who had as one of his main jobs keeping you the hell out of the wet canteen and trying to stop other soldiers from swearing in front of you. We were pretty Victorian in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Both of these exercises were exercises in futility, of course. When you were in camp, you got an extra 5 cents a day, which was a big deal, field allowance. So that was the militia in those days. We had some very distinguished soldiers who in Seaforth Hounders in those days, who became quite famous later on, not the least of which is our present Lieutenant Governor, who was at one point my platoon commander, just before he got promoted to captain, Colonel Merritt, who won the Victoria Cross, Dieppe, Bertie Hoffmeister, who rose to the dizzy ranks of Major General during World War II, was also a member of the Sea Force. And there were many others too, but those three come to mind as being quite famous. The militia was great fun.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, of course, a different feeling in those days. It was clear that there was going to be a war with Germany in due course. While we didn't know what was happening in terms of Hitler's final solution for the Jewish problem, It was obvious that he was one of the bad guys. It took me a lot of years to figure out that war is very often fought on the basis of economics as opposed to anything else. However, that's another story. In those days, I was far too young, too naive, and too unsophisticated to look at anything but the pipes playing and the Sea Force, of course, had not only a fine regimental pipe band, two of them, in fact. Cadet pipe band and the battalion's pipe band. It also had a brass band, so we had all sorts of music all the time, and it was something. It was the beginnings of, for me at least, a lifetime love affair with the Army, which I continue to this day. It was good fun for a young man, and it kept you off the streets. It was some place to go. Friends I made in those days, I have today. those that managed to survive. Many of them, of course, didn't. So went for before the war.
Well, were you involved in any of the bands or sports teams with the regiment?
Well, I played basketball for the regiment, and I played soccer for the regiment. And I was originally enlisted. The reason I got in underage as a boy soldier, I decided that I was already a corporal in the cadets. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I'd like to have a shot at being in the battalion, you know, with the big guys. And so I went to get myself recruited into the battalion, you see, and of course they knew me because the C4th is a very tight family. Once a C4th, always a C4th. From the day I enlisted until the day World War II was over, the C4th Ladies Auxiliary kept sending me parcels. You know. Anyway, I went in to enlist, and they were looking for buglers. And so I allowed it. I thought that couldn't be too hard to learn. I'd learned all these other military traits. I should be able to learn to play the bugle. So the recruiting sergeant said, can you blow the bugle? And I said, certainly. And he handed me one right then and there. And those days, bugles were bugles. They didn't have valves like the trumpets they use nowadays. And of course, I got a bit of a squeak out of it, and that was it. And he sort of shook his head. So I figured I had blown it. And then I heard a voice behind me say, perhaps the laddie can play the drum. And I figured, I'm saved. I can be a drummer. And of course, this was a big deal. I'd just been watching drums on, you know, the Gunga Din and all these kind of movies at the time. You know, tremendous stuff. And so I was enlisted as a boy drummer, given a set of drumsticks. But I never got to getting a drum. They used to train you on a table, 6 foot folding, and stand there beating your flams and double flams on it. And I never really got good enough for the regiment to trust me with a drum. And finally, after about 6 months of this, I was posted into the boy soldiers platoon. My platoon sergeant was a fellow by the name of Ledbetter. I can remember the day I arrived. He took one look at me and he said, "Kid, fish is brain food. Go to the canteen and eat a whale." I took him literally, you know. I went to the canteen to see if there was any fish and chips. I was really green, you know. Sergeant Ledbetter, Distinguished Conduct Medal, MM from the Great War. He had hands like 1x6s. And I should know, when we were in camp in, is this the sort of thing you want?
Oh yeah, this is cool.
When we were in camp in Sydney in 1938, there were no beer parlors or anything in Victoria in those days, but there were beer parlors in Sydney. And some of the older fellows in the company decided that it was time that I went to the beer parlor with them, you see. Some of them would be embarrassed about this story, but Doug Hambry, who's sort of the major, Lieutenant Colonel Hambry, who's sort of the major domo at Government House, was one of the crew. They took me to the pub. In those days when we walked out, we carried sidearms. Everybody wore a bayonet. Wasn't just your web belt, you carried your bayonet. When they sat me down in the pub and they ordered beer all around, you see, and the guy, I was very thin in those days, and not fair. And, you know, I didn't even look how old the age I was. So the beer waiter took one look at me, said, "I'm not serving that kid anything." Whereupon about 5 bayonets were laid on the table, and he said, "Oh yes, you will." "Yeah, I guess I will," says this guy. So I had 2 glasses of beer. And really, I wasn't tight, but I thought I should have been. And we got back to the company lines just after last post. In other words, just in time to be sort of sneaking in and getting into your tent. But I thought that I should be tight. So I was staggering up and down the lines in the boy soldiers platoon tents, L tents, banging on the tent flaps with my bayonet, shouting, "Wakey, wakey, wakey." And everyone was throwing old boots at me and everything. And the next thing I knew, I was grabbed by the scruff of the neck. And it was my platoon sergeant, old Sergeant Ledbetter. And he said, "You want the platoon turned out?" "I'll turn the platoon out." So he did. He got them all out of bed. Got them standing there, 2 ranks. Those are the days when we still did everything in 4s before they did them in 3s. brought them all smartly to attention, stood them all at ease, then stood them easy. He said, now you've got the platoon out, and I feel I should entertain the platoon. Boy, drummer's drums piled out in front of the platoon. He sat down on the drum, one of the drums, turned me over his knee, whipped up my kilt, and paddled my bare ass with his great huge hands in front of the whole platoon. That was my first lesson in how to handle booze. It's bad enough when you are drunk, but never pretend to be drunk. So that was my first experience. Came back to haunt me years later. That was in 1938. In 42, after I graduated from Gordon Head, and we were passing through Vancouver going to our next point, it was customary for the sergeant's mess at Little Mountain, which of course is Princess Margaret Park in Vancouver now, but at that time it was a military establishment. It was really run by the Seaforths. At least all the most of the NCOs in the mess were Seaforth Islanders. And all the newly commissioned young officers in the Seaforths were taken there for a mess dinner. And the RSM, Mr. Anderson, who had been RSM of the regiment in 1939, but had been too old to go overseas, would call on senior NCOs and warrant officers to tell their own story, you see. And mine came last. And I was hoping against hope it wouldn't happen, but it did. The RSM looked down the table, and there was W02 Leadbetter by this time. I've been promoted a couple of times. Sergeant Major Leadbetter, perhaps you'd have something to say about Mr. Dudley. And Leadbetter stood up and told the whole story about the time he spanked my bum in front of the whole boy soldiers platoon.
Yeah.
But it was very much a family. Mm-hmm. It was so much a family, as a matter of fact, that you would find, as a boy soldier, that your company commander would be checking at your school to find out how your marks were going.
Really?
That's not the sort of thing that happens nowadays, even given a first-class militia unit like the Canadian Scottish. But in those days, they were making damn good and sure that your obligations to the uniform were not going to be to the detriment of your education. And I'm grateful for it, because I had the bare, when I was finally commissioned, I had the bare minimum education possible to get commissioned. So anyway, that was my experience with, I think that probably covers sort of the highlights. I loved the camps. They were great.
What did you usually do at the camp?
Oh, this was field training.
Yeah.
Sections, platoons, companies. And the last two or three days was generally Red Army against the Blue Army, or White Army against the Blue Army. I forgot what they used to call them those days. And this was wandering around in the field. The instruction was very much related to World War I, of course. We're always one war behind. Although section tactics were improving, because the weapons, we knew that new weapons were going to show up on the scene. There was a lot of work on the ranges, to everybody firing their classifications, and people handling the. It was an opportunity to handle weapons that you didn't see during the rest of the year, because there weren't enough of them to go around, so that we got chances to fire our classifications on the Lewis gun, and play with 3-inch mortar, all of these kinds of things. Things that you weren't able to do in the normal course of training. We had lots of weekend training, the same as, not as much, but the same as the Canadian Scottish do now. And so that we were generally busy. And the Army became a real, and not only to me, but to the group of us that were in the boys, well, most of them went on to be commissioned. About half of them, I guess, a third of them at least were killed. About another 40% of them, probably about 40% of them remained in the regular Army after the war. And the rest went on to greater glories in the business and professional world.
How well was the regiment equipped as far as equipment goes? Pretty outdated, or was it?
Not too bad. Considering the times and the economics, we were in the Seaforths. We were armed with short model Lee Enfields, which was a great war, a World War One rifle, and in my opinion, the best of them. Mm-hmm. It was a better rifle, in my opinion, than what we were armed with in World War Two.
Hmm. Why is that?
I don't know. It was better. It was bedded better. You seem to be able to develop more accuracy. It is, after all, the weapon that the Canadian Corps was famous for its accuracy with, and you could develop a good rate of fire. It carried 10 rounds in the magazine, same as the one that was issued to us in World War II, but I thought it was a better rifle, but there are other people who will tell you differently. We had Lewis guns, but not enough of them. Everybody got around to training on them and learning how to take them apart and put them together and that sort of thing. We had, a mortar platoon generally has six 3-inch mortars, and we might have had two in the battalion. We had no track vehicles like carriers or anything like that. We didn't have very many vehicles, period, and certainly the Jeep had never made an appearance by this time. So infantry did what infantry have always done. They walked everywhere. It used to be a long walk up that hill, Mission Hill, with everything you owned on your back to the top of it in Camp Vernon. Sydney, of course, was much better. Lots of flat country in Sydney, but Vernon, there was nothing but hills, and you were always running up them. But I'd say that basically we were relatively well equipped in terms of the equipment that was available at that time. Shortly after the World War II broke out, the Lewis gun, of course, was replaced by the Bren gun, which is probably the best light machine gun that's ever been devised, including today's. In fact, it was so accurate they had to take one of the forward grips off it because you were putting a burst all in a space like so. Hmm. You need to have some sort of spray with a light machine gun. In any event, we weren't all that badly equipped. What we had were fine non-commissioned officers, and this was true of the whole militia, not just the Sea Force or Camp Scots or two battalions in those days. All of the units had first-class non-commissioned officers. So World War II hadn't been over that long, or the Great War hadn't been over that long. It meant that there were still lots of fellas who were very useful as instructors, mm-hmm. and they remembered what the Great War was like. And they could tell you which ones you stood up for and which ones you ducked for and so on. You know. They were good. What we had were, and this was true of the regular Army too, even more so, of course. We had just super instructors. I look back at my relationship with Ledbetter, who Ledbetter and the sergeant, whose name is escaping me, who commanded the Vancouver City Police Detachment, the Mounted Detachment. My father, having been in a cavalry regiment when I was about 10 years old, decided I should learn how to ride a horse. And that's where I learned, because the sergeant who commanded the City Police Detachment in Stanley Park had been my father's squadron sergeant major in the 2nd Canadian Mounted Rifles. Mm. And that's where I learned to ride.
In Stanley Park.
That's right. Courtesy of the Vancouver City Police. If anything like that happened nowadays, there'd be people screaming corruption and that kind of thing. What they got from me, though, for the first 5 week weekend was just shoveling the shit in the stable. That was the end of the horse I became most familiar with for the first 6 weeks. We moved, and then after that we were taught bareback, and then finally in a saddle and so on, uh-huh. cavalry style.
What a privilege.
Was indeed.
How about the regiment's relationship with the community?
Pretty good, I'd say. Different world then. Nowadays, if you're in the regular army, half the people on the street figure you're too honest to steal and too lazy to work. But it was pretty good, I'd say. They used to line the streets and cheer and clap mm-hmm. and all that kind of thing. Military parades were something to behold, you know, I'd say pretty good. There was certainly in 1939 there was a flocking to the colors like you wouldn't believe. People were disappointed who couldn't get in right away, had to wait, and certainly for the first few years of the war, when we weren't taking a lot of casualties or anything, We were well equipped with volunteers, and we really fought the whole war till maybe the last month or so with volunteers. And mm-hmm. the, you know, they and the conscripted troops didn't arrive overseas until three or four weeks before the end of the war, by and large. And no, I'd say that the relationship between the community and the Sea Force, and the community and the Irish Fusiliers and the Duke of Connaught's Own Rifles and all the other militia units in the city was excellent, really. Given the times, as I say, bear in mind, they weren't a few. Most of these battalions had lots of people. You could turn out 600-700 men on parade, you know. When they were asked to volunteer, everybody volunteered. All of those who wished to volunteer for overseas service, one pace forward march, and the whole battalion moved, you know. There was no problem with that. Mm-hmm. It's hard to, for me as a as an old soldier, to equate this with what one sees on the streets now. Since Mr. Hellyer's treasonous exercises of removing the differential, the differences between the services and so on. Anyway, those are the sorts of things I remember from the militia days. Mm-hmm. Great fun, just mm-hmm. great fun. Loved every minute of it.
Yeah.
And as I say, it was a grand grounding. And there were lots of your school chums who were in the militia and that kind of thing. It's a way to be part of something. We didn't have the sort of things for youth nowadays that or then that we have nowadays, and so if you were sort of oriented towards this, of course, all my uncles had served in the Great War, or many of them, most of them had. They'd been in the Machine Gun Corps and the Mounted Rifles and the Royal Flying Corps and so on, and so it was a natural thing for me to wish to be a soldier. I was the first one, I guess, in the family to want to be a regular soldier, although my father maintained his connection in the militia with the BCD in the intervening years and reported to it immediately that they were called up. So,
how about the other fellows in the regiment? What was their reason for joining most of these forces?
Much the same as mine, I think. Uh-huh. The uniforms were pretty snappy. They were great for getting girls.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely nothing like it. And nowadays, of course, I guess girls aren't that impressed with uniforms. But in those days, as I say, we were very much more naive. I'm not saying that newer is better either. But the uniforms, the kilt, different. You know, we had a scarlet doublet for fancy parades like Royal Guards of Honor and that kind of thing. I don't suppose there were enough of them to go around, but the 100 men were always fully outfitted in feather bonnet scarlets and white gaiters and red and white diced hose and sporran. Cadet uniform was probably the best looking uniform in Canada.
Yeah.
We had more uniforms than the cadets than the battalion had. Actually, we wore khaki mostly in the battalion, except for when we were on these great parades. But the cadets, we had a blue doublet that, if I remember correctly, had something like 40 pieces of brass on it, all of which had to be shined. And we also had a khaki tunic that we wore in the field, and kilt aprons and sporrans and khaki gaiters and white gaiters and Glengarries and that kind of thing. Absolutely nothing like showing up at high school at the evening dances that would occur from time to time wearing your cadet uniform. Just great.
Yeah.
Super. Never had any trouble getting dates in those days.
You just show up.
I always tell everybody that I was in the Army for 4 years before I found out any other infantry soldiers wore trousers. It was good fun.
Yeah. Did you have to pay for your uniforms?
No. Had to pay a deposit in the cadets. $12 for a used uniform that my mother heaved in the basement, the first one I brought home. And I remember saying to her, "You can't do that to the King's uniform." She's like, "I can do it to the King's uniform until we get it cleaned up." But as I got, as soon as I won my first promotion, I got a brand new uniform. We had, there was no paying for uniforms. The officers did, because officers have always had to pay for their uniform. And in the battalion, they were an issue. And So you had to pay for anything you lost. I had a dear friend in the Sea Force. He got killed in the Hitler line, but when we came home from summer camp in Vernon in 1939, after he'd been there for a month, he owed the Army $5. But, he'd been paid once, but at the final pay, he owed the Army $5. He'd lost a pair of boots or some bloody thing.
Any sort of social activities organized?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There were all the regimental holidays were duly met. There was the officers' mess, of course, was a very social arrangement. Of course, when I wasn't in that role at that time. But certainly they had regimental parties and dances. And of course, the Highland Games was always a big thing in the Sea Force, as it was in the Canadian Scottish. We had lots of athletics and great dances in the Sea Force armories and all of that sort of thing. Oh, yeah, absolutely. They were. And the cadets had the annual cadet ball, right down to starched shirts and wing collars, and you wore your doublet open, but with a red cummerbund and gold chains between the bottom two buttons. Oh, yes, great stuff. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. The only way to go. There was lots of that, yeah. There was a canteen, wet and dry. It was a place, where after you'd done your parade, you could go and have a beer and shoot the breeze. I couldn't, because I was a boy soldier. The orderly sergeant would kick my ass out. But we'd be instructed to go straight home. We never did. Tried to wiggle our way into bars downtown, and did from time to time.
What was the drinking age at that time?
Oh, 21. By the time the war was over, I'd been in action best part of 2 years altogether between the Edmund Regiment and the number 4 Commando and one thing or another. By the time the war was over, I still wasn't old enough to go into a bar in this country. And I was an acting captain. There used to be a sign in one of the pubs in London, and we were not served lieutenant colonels under the age of 21. It was weird, yeah. It was a long time before they got the drinking age down. If you're old enough to fight, you're old enough to drink. Yeah. Otherwise, you're going to miss out on the whole thing. So far.
So what sort of promotions did you have in the regiment?
Well, I got promoted as far as sergeant, and then almost within a month of me becoming a sergeant, some dimwit decided that I would maybe make an officer. And myself and my dearest friend at that time, Gordon McWilliams, were sent off to London town to the Canadian military headquarters to be interviewed for getting a commission. And I wasn't really too enchanted with this idea at the time. I was having a great time. It was super being a platoon sergeant, But I knew my dad would be pleased. By this time, he was a major in his own regiment, and he was overseas at the same time. So off we went. And besides that, the RSM had taken both of us to one side and said we were all ready. The term Peter Principle hadn't been devised then, but the implication was clear. We had already reached the height of our abilities as NCOs, and maybe we see if we could become officers. So that was an entertaining exercise. I don't know if we're at that point yet or not, but that was an entertaining exercise. We went up to London to CMHQ to be interviewed by this board. And of course, in the Army fashion, they took all the guys, they take you all alphabetically. So of course, I get in before McWilliams does. And when I get in, there's a brigadier there and two full colonels and about four half colonels, one of whom is my father's commanding officer, Colonel Rock. So I get marched in left, right. And there I am, all dressed up, best bib and tucker, wearing a kilt, which of course was illegal in those days because they removed them from us, but all the sergeants had them. We always walked out in a kilt, red infantry sash, the whole works. And when I got marched in, they said, one chair, and they tell you to sit on it. So I sat down, and Colonel Rock looked at me and said, oh, Sergeant Dudley, have you seen your father recently? And I said, yes, sir, I'd seen him the previous weekend. No. And then he turned to the brigadier, he said, Major Dudley is my headquarters squadron commander. So that got me an edge, you know, got a father who's an officer. Anyway, they asked me a whole bunch of questions about my military background, such as it was, and one thing and another.
How old were you at this point?
That was in 42, I guess, eh? I guess I wasn't quite 18. I would be 18 in November of 42. I'd be 18 in November of 42. But the Army thought I was older, because I'd lied about my age. That was the deal that my parents had seen. So anyway, this one full colonel looks at me and he says, "Well, Sergeant Dudley, what makes you think you can be an officer?" And I countered by saying, "The last 5 or 6 weeks, my platoon officer has been on course, and so I've been commanding the platoon. Now, sir, he gets $5 a day for this, but I only get $2.20 a day, and I don't see any reason why I shouldn't get $5 a day." And he sort of grinned, and pretty cheeky, you know, sort of an adolescent response to his kind of thing. Anyway, he sort of grinned. Somebody asked me a couple of questions, and that was it. And I came out. They don't tell you right off the bat, but then I had to wait until McWilliams went in, see, because we were off to the pub. The big attraction here was a 48-hour pass in London once we got this nonsense on Friday afternoon. So McWilliams goes in. I guess I was in there 15 or 20 minutes, but McWilliams was only in there about 4 or 5 minutes, and he was out. And I knew right when he came out through the door, he was a year older than me. He had this stupid grin on his face. He got out. I said, "How the hell did you get out of there so fast?" He said, "Well," he said, "Christ, I was sitting there, and some bloody colonel said to me, 'What makes you think you can be an officer?'" He said, "I looked each one of them in the eye, and then I said, 'From looking around here, anybody can be an officer.'" And whereupon the brigadier said, "That'll be all, Sergeant McWilliams," and that was the end of it. And if I'd known he was going to do something stunned like that, I'd have tried that myself. But that was how it went. And of course, he didn't go. He wound up in the 1st Canadian Parachute Battalion. They were recruited partly in Canada and partly from troops overseas. And Mac went to the Para Battalion, having had to give up his stripes. The NCOs had to start over again as privates in the Para Battalion. By the time Normandy rolled around, he was back to 3 stripes. I had seen him in Ringway when I was doing the parachute course. And he was taken in Norway. They had a very bad time, the 1st Para Battalion. And he was telling me after the war, he said, "Christ," he said, "there I was. There were 7 guys left in the platoon, and I'd spread it out. We had about 5 rounds each. And this German officer had been after us to surrender because we were creating some sort of havoc. And he was totally surrounded. And he said, he asked me, and he said, I took my knife out. We used to carry it in the Para Battalion. We used to carry a knife in our jump boots. They cut your lines if things went adrift. That's right. I took my knife out, and I looked at my Thompson. I figured I had 10 rounds in the mag. I took my knife out, and I was just about to tell him to go to hell. And then I thought, this is insane. You're going to get killed. So he surrendered, and they took him prisoner. And they stuffed him in a PW camp from which he promptly escaped. And he batted around and with the underground till the Allies caught up with him. So he wasn't in a PW camp long, and he was awarded the Military Medal. So he did all right, and he was subsequently after the war. He got touched with this fever. He went back to the seaport. After he got over being balshy, and somebody in their right mind in the C-4 made arrangements for Gordon to become an officer, so that's how he did his thing.
How was the regiment back in Vancouver preparing, or how was it sort of accommodating the approaching signs of war, or whatever? How was it changing?
Oh, I think training got a little keener. There were more lectures, there were more current affairs lectures, that kind of thing. We had all these sort of super instructors, particularly the NCOs. Some of the officers were very good too, the World War I types. they were preparing to the extent that they could prepare, considering the limitations and funds that were available to them. It was an interesting period in anybody's life to have been in that situation at that time.
Mm-hmm. How did the regiment deal with this big influx of new recruits?
Well, there wasn't a big influx in the recruits,
right.
Actually. It didn't take long. As I say, within 2 days they were totally at the strength, even accounting for those people who'd been found medically unfit to proceed overseas. And the unit knew it was selected first, it was going in the 1st Division, so that everybody who wanted to get overseas, people on Surrey Street. There was one guy, it was before I got kicked out at 39, because of being underage, and I was acting as the orderly for the recruiting sergeant. Right? There were two recruiting sergeants, two orderlies. And you had to run and get the orderly sergeant coffee in. Or the recruiting sergeant coffee or take attestation papers to the orderly room, that kind of thing. But I thought it was a pretty important job. This guy arrives in front of the recruiting sergeant, and he is one of the toughest looking guys I've ever seen. I'd say he was about 5'10". He had a face like 10 miles of bad road, and he didn't have an ounce of fat on him. He was just as muscular and tough looking as anybody I've ever seen, almost evil looking. And, of course, there were questions that were asked, see? Name, this guy gives his name. And occupation, this guy says, machine gun. No, not what you want to do in the Army. What do you do? What's your occupation? He says, I'm a machine gunner. And after a certain, by this time, I'm sort of looking at this guy, and I think, Christ, he maybe is a machine gunner. Visions of him holding up banks a la Al Capone and that kind of thing. Turned out that he had just got back from Spain. And he had soldiered in the Lincoln Brigades in Spain, I guess in the Mackenzie Papineau Battalion. And he'd soldiered in Spain, and he got back just in time for World War II to break out, so he was going back again. But prior to Spain, he'd spent 7 years in the Foreign Legion as well. And that's what he was. He was a machine gunner. He'd never been a civilian. And, of course, once they found out that he'd been in Spain, he was non-acceptable as a recruit. Because in those days, if you'd served in the Mackenzie Papineau Battalion, you were considered to be tarred with the brush of communism. And so he learned a lesson there. He subsequently went to the Duke of Connaught's own rifles, and this time he hadn't been in Spain. What's your previous occupation? Logger. Everybody was a logger in British Columbia. He had a job. And so he got in all right, but only after having been turned down. The recruiting sergeant sort of said, try the Dukes. You know, the recruiting sergeant was no dummy. He was a really bright guy. Mm-hmm. Donaldson, his name was. Funny, I remember all these names and stuff so many years ago. But anyway, he got turned down for various reasons. And I guess he walked straight out of our armories and went over to the Besra armories and enlisted in the Duke of Connaught's own rifles and wound up riding in a tank. 4th Division later on, presumably. I never heard or saw them again. But I did run across various other people who the word got out, if you want to get into the Canadian Army, you don't tell them you've been in Spain. It was easy to say you've been bumming back and forth across the country because all of the young men in the country were riding their rods back and forth across the country. So that's what you said. You didn't say you'd been in Spain. I thought it was short-sighted in the Army's point, part of view even then, and he was an experienced hand who was a machine gunner. That's what he did for a living, you know. But that was, and he could tell you about every machine gun that ever came down the pike, from Maxims to Vickers to Brownings, you name it. Anyway, that was the story.
What other reasons were there for men being turned away other than not enough room?
Well, I don't think there were very many men turned away. Once the battalion was up the strength, of course, you had to build reinforcement companies. Nobody knew that they were going to hang around England for as long as they did before they went to action. So the volunteers were all accommodated. I don't think there was any question of people not getting in. The boy soldiers were released. A very nice little speech by Colonel Ferry, who was commanding the Colonel Leslie, T.S. Leslie, Tom Leslie was commanding the town at the time. And he had to surrender command of it to Colonel Ferry to take it over to you. T.S. Leslie had a DSO and MC from the Great War, and he'd been practically cut in half by machine gun fire. And I saw him when the battalion moved, got on board the train in the old CPR station in Vancouver, tears streaming down his face. We didn't feel so good either. You know, battalion was going away and we knew these guys. But he took all the boy soldiers off to one side, the colonel of the regiment, which I thought was pretty smashing. And he said, look, you'll all get your chances. It's going to be a long war. He was a wise old bird. He said, you're all going to get your chances, but just think about this. I'm never going to get my chance again. And I think he stayed in for quite a while. I think he commanded at Little Mountain there for a while and that sort of thing. He made us all go back to the cadets. We hadn't formed. They formed another militia battalion after a while, but as luck would have it, some of the NCOs and the cadets, myself included, were busy instructing them. You know, they were really green. And we had so we all went back to the cadets until it was time for us to sneak our way back into the Army again. So there you are.
Were you issued any new weaponry during this period of mobilization?
No, that was...